Let me introduce our speaker today. Probably all of you know enough so that this is unnecessary, but I will do it anyway. There may be some details that you don't know about Honora O'Neill. She is currently Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge. She's held many distinguished positions over the course of her career, including the principal of Newnham College in Cambridge for a long time, also president of the British Academy, and she's currently chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which will give some added significance to today's talk. She has a very great many books, very embarrassing to the rest of us who try to write books. I think your earliest book was Acting on Principle in 1975, which was highly influential in the revival of Kantian ethics in contemporary philosophy. She has written other books with Kantian themes, Constructions of Reason, but also a book called Towards Justice and Virtue, books also on global justice, an early book called Faces, not that early, but a book published quite a while back called Faces of Hunger. More recently, some work focusing on trust. Her book, Autonomy and Trust in Bioethics, was presented as the Gifford Lectures at St. Andrews. I guess St. Andrews, not Edinburgh anymore. And then there were her Reith Lectures called A Question of Trust. And there is now forthcoming another book on global justice called Justice Across Boundaries, Whose Obligations? Today she's going to speak with us about human rights. So I'll turn it over to Honora now. And I hope you won't mind, I'll be sitting on the floor over here.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Now I have a confession to start with, which might create some spaces on chairs. An early version of this talk was given as the Wolfson Lecture at Wolfson College 18 months ago. So if you think, been there, done that, don't want to hear how the story ended, then somebody else can have a chair. But that explains why I decided that if I was to talk about the justification of human rights, it might be important to think about pluralism. Today, when we do political philosophy and we think about pluralism, we tend to think about John Rawls, yet I think Rawls it was deeply influenced by Berlin's writing on pluralism. So I'm going to start with Berlin, but I will get on to Rawlsian territory. And it's called Pluralism, Positivism, and the Justification of Human Rights, but perhaps if I had fitted one more word into the title, I would have disambiguated it as Pluralism, Legal Positivism, and the Justification of Human Rights. In short, I'm not going to say anything about logical positivism. I suspect there are deep connections between legal and logical positivism. One can sort of see what some of them might be quite quickly, but I'm just not going to comment on that. So let me just begin with a few little thoughts about pluralism. There are lots of discussions of pluralism in a lot of disciplines, but nearly all of them do not focus on what has been called value pluralism. That was, and certainly not on value pluralism as that phrase was understood by Isaiah Berlin. A lot of discussions on pluralism focus on the thought that there are a lot of things, or at least a number of things of various sorts, and it's obviously true, which is nice. And any approach to ethics or political philosophy is going to have to take account of the fact that there are empirical pluralities. After all, accounts of justice have to assume that a plurality of people are going to be subject to its demands. Solipsists, I take it, don't have to worry too much about justice. Early modern writers often developed this thought and linked the fact that there are many possible subjects of justice to the fact that they are in competition for scarce resources. So if you read Locke or Hume or Kant, they all see the fact that many of us share a finite earth as among the basic, to use Hume's phrase, circumstances of justice. But a second range of perhaps nowadays more familiar claims about pluralities focuses not on the fact that there are lots and lots of subjects of justice, but on the fact that they also have varying conceptions of the world, varying ethical and political views. That's much more familiar from Rawls's writings. The empirical evidence that people hold many different moral and political views was, of course, already of great importance in early modern discussions of toleration and free speech. But they acquired wider importance in political philosophy in the 20th century, I think both through Isaiah Berlin's writings and because John Rawls and others later very persistently emphasised that pluralism of beliefs and outlooks is ineradicable. Rawls held, quote, that the fact of reasonable pluralism is a permanent feature of democratic societies whose citizens affirm irreconcilable and incommensurable conceptions of the good. And he concluded that while people whose conceptions of the good differ can indeed reach agreement on a conception of justice, normative justification cannot reach beyond matters of justice. That's Rawls in his later work. Now, Isaiah Berlin wasn't, in fact, mainly concerned with the fact that people hold lots of different beliefs and values, but with the bearing that this will have on attempts to justify substantive moral and political claims, including liberal claims, and thereby, of course, also any claims one wants to make about human rights. But unlike Rawls, Berlin doesn't think that reasonable agreement among fellow citizens will be enough to justify principles of justice. Towards the end of his life, Berlin noted, quote, I have for many years thought that the problem of the incommensurability and still more the incompatibility of some values is central to all ethical, social, political, and aesthetic issues. The distinction he drew between value pluralism and what he called, it's not a common phrase now, value monism, was a lasting feature of Berlin's thought. And I think it's easy enough to grasp his concern. He isn't worried by the empirical facts that there are lots of us, or that there are a number of worldviews or a number of ethical outlooks, or by run-of-the-mill ethical and political disagreements, but by the reality, as he thinks, that we lack any robust way of resolving these fundamental ethical disagreements. Now, many philosophical discussions of the plurality of values that people actually claim to hold, assert, or at least they hope, that this is not going to be an insurmountable problem. Writers who locate justification in agreement except that we won't have deep justification, the sort that value monism, if it were available, would supposedly provide. But they claim that the right solution is to take a less demanding view of justification. Deep justification is not available, so we should settle for something else. Well, what? It could be barefaced relativism, or one or another version of the thought that justifications themselves can be plural, each of them anchored in whatever agreement can be reached in particular societies or communities at particular times or within particular sorts of discourse. And perhaps, with the additional Rawlsian thought, that there will be some sort of overlapping consensus between these different justifications. Particularly in his later work, Rawls saw normative justification as, this is so interesting, internal to bounded liberal democratic societies within which citizens can reason and come to agreement on a conception of justice, even if they cannot agree on any wider conception of the good. That's the core of so-called political liberalism. Habermas, too, subordinates the project of justification to reasoning that allows for free exchange of views, such as we may be secured by democratic deliberation. So he too sees justification as essentially civic, and communitarians, as we know, have appealed to culturally narrower contexts of agreement as sources of justification. But value monists, as Berlin thought of them, aimed higher. Their ambition could be satisfied only by an objective only if objective ethical values could be justified by appeal to a single set of premises, for example, derived from a single metric of value, such as, though I don't think Berlin would have thought much of it, such as utilitarians invoke, or appealing to a single authority, such as the divine will. But without value monist foundations, Berlin concluded, some values that matter greatly may turn out to be incommensurable or incompatible with others, and deep justification of values, and specifically of claims about justice or about rights, may simply elude us. Let me now turn to human rights. Does it matter if we can't offer any deep justification for human rights? Human rights have, we know, never been more widely endorsed than they are today, and although respect for them and realization of them remains very patchy across the world, lip service is ubiquitous, or near to ubiquitous. But this acceptance doesn't reflect any wider or deeper agreement that human rights can be justified. Rather, I think it reflects the thought that justification has come to many to seem less urgent, perhaps a waste of time. In part, I suggest, because human rights have so often been beneficiaries of their own worldly success. There's, of course, a degree of convergence. Many political philosophers follow rules in arguing that despite the plurality of views people hold, political justifications, and that's of course a term of art, political justifications of principles of justice are feasible. And many human rights lawyers and activists and others reach a rather similar position by appealing to positive legal enactments. Human rights, it is said, are now incorporated into the international architecture. They are transposed into treaties and legislation. They now constitute positive requirements. Rights that were once merely declared or disputed have been incorporated into international covenants and conventions. Very often the covenants and conventions have been ratified by states, and in consequence states are committed to respecting and realizing human rights, even if many states make rather little effort to do so. Both philosophical pluralists and legal positivists conclude, or tend to conclude, that deeper justification is now not needed. Political or legal facts can trump, or you might think just short-circuit, hankerings for deeper justification. But can we really set aside the aim of justifying human rights claims? Can we substitute appeals to public agreement or state action? Are human rights adequately seen just as matters of agreement or of treaty and law? What are the costs of relying on justifications that are no more than political, in the Rawlsian sense of that term, or no more than positive, in the legal sense of that term? Has the project of trying to justify the human rights that were proclaimed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 or the European Convention on Human Rights of 1950 or in countless other human rights documents and international treaties and covenants really been made redundant by a happy convergence between moral and political pluralism and legal positivism? Many people remain sceptical about political and positivist substitutes for deeper justification. Some of them reject these substitutes for justification because they actually reject the human rights that were proclaimed in the Universal Declaration or the European Convention, seeing them as attempts to impose Western standards or even as masks for imperialism. They deny that the mere facts of declaration or ratification provide any justification. They sometimes argue that there should be different rights for different societies. In short, that the declaration rights shouldn't have universal scope. Others don't argue that human rights are a Western imposition, but they're very well aware that the Universal Declaration and the European Convention reflect recent history and its preoccupations, and they take a guarded rather than a reverent view of the rights declared. They don't think that agreement or enactment provides an adequate substitute for justification. The historical points that have been adduced by so many sceptics about justification are, I think, pretty much accurate. those who framed the leading human rights documents indeed drew on earlier Western claims about natural rights and the rights of man, and what they produced reflected a specific historical situation in which Western values were riding high, though widely shared in non-Western societies. That declaration, Universal Declaration, is a central part of the post-World War II settlement and of the institutional structures it established. The rights declared were to be acknowledged by the accession of states to the United Nations and later by their ratification of the more specific versions of human rights subsequently set out in international covenants and conventions. So I think that while some answers to the question, why are human rights binding, are going to be political or positive, these answers will have weight only in contexts in which appeals to positive law or enactments or to political agreements are appropriate, because these approaches duck rather than address the more fundamental questions about justification. They take either prior exercises of state authority or prior agreement as the basis for human rights. By bracketing questions about any deeper justification of human rights standards, they, of course, lose any basis for criticising political cultures or states that do not endorse human rights. Positive or political justifications are limited and time-limited, and they may lose their appeal as the legitimacy, powers and enactments of states change, as indeed they have been changed and are being changed by processes of globalisation and conflict. One would, I think, expect those who purport to take these standards seriously to be pretty concerned about the limits of pluralist and positivist support for human rights standards, perhaps to be worried that human rights might at some future point come to lack status even in the jurisdictions and cultures in which they are currently, if sometimes tenuously, anchored. And indeed, many strong supporters of the Universal Declaration of Rights see the dangers of this approach and maintain that positivist and pluralist approaches to justification are inadequate, and that human rights are more than agreements or enactments of a particular historical moment to which states have committed themselves, at least for the time being. For better or for worse, human rights are still very widely seen as fundamental moral claims that human beings can make on one another, and in particular on states and their institutions and officials, and even, or especially, when existing institutional structures fail to recognise, protect or secure these claims. When the citizens of rogue states are arbitrarily tortured or imprisoned without trial, or deprived of their livelihoods, nobody says, oh, well, that's okay, those states haven't signed up to the relevant human rights instruments. And nobody regards it as acceptable if they've signed up but then taken no effective steps to meet or to secure the standards to which they signed up, which unfortunately, as you all know, is not too uncommon. Most supporters of human rights, I think, hold, in some form or another, that they must have deeper or more substantial justification than could be provided by the mere facts of political agreement or of state ratification and institutionalisation. Rogue states are not seen as escaping, but as flouting human rights claim. And criticism is directed not only at blatant flouting, but also that persisting failure to create the basic institutions for respecting and protecting human rights, the rule of law, a competent and non-corrupt judiciary. In short, human rights are still, I think, very widely seen neither as merely positive rights nor as matters of contingent political consensus, but as fundamental rights held by all human beings. And indeed, unless proponents of human rights take it that there are deeper justifications that are not merely positive or merely political, they're not going to be able to offer reasons for respecting human rights to those who are disinclined to do so. That, I suggest, is where pluralist and positive attempts to domesticate questions of justification have landed us. What to do? Let me make a brief excursion back to Berlin. Berlin didn't argue that standards of justification should be weakened. That was is what makes him interestingly different from some of our contemporaries. He merely argued that we're not in a position to meet these demands. He takes it that values are objective and would have seen, as far as I can read him, both positivist and political substitutes for justification as inadequate. But he also thought that value monism was not available because it requires strong metaphysical or theological underpinnings which we cannot supply. So he sees the real cost of value pluralism as high, indeed, as he writes, tragically high, because it leaves us without deep justifications. He wrote, "The notion of the perfect whole, the ultimate solution in which all good things coexist, seems to me not merely unobtainable, that's a truism, but conceptually incoherent. Some among the great goods cannot live together. That's a conceptual truth. We're doomed to choose, and every choice may entail an irreparable loss." That's from A Crooked Timber of Humanity. Well, do those strong but tragic conclusions follow from our lack of a monistic vindication of all values, or at least of justice, or at least of human rights? Might there not be other routes to justifying at least some fundamental principles, including those most relevant for the public sphere, such as some human rights standards? Might a metaphysically less demanding view of justification be possible that doesn't reduce justification to contingent matters of positive law or political agreement? And I'm going to explore parts of these questions by considering a further approach to the justification of human rights claims. I don't assume that human rights claims are the only normative claims that raise questions of justification, but I at least take them to be an important case, and also, as I hope to suggest, a relatively tractable set of standards for justifications that are neither positivist nor pluralist and that are available even if we cannot establish any form of value monism. And this, I shall argue, is because any system of universal rights would have to meet at least three rather demanding formal conditions. So I'm now going to talk about interpreting rights, not about implementing them, about interpreting them. The most fundamental feature of human rights standards is their universal scope. Whatever else they are, human rights are to set standards for everybody. That's not to say that questions of scope need no justification, and Berlin, like many others, pointed in horror at positions such as slavery or Nazism that deny recognition or moral standing to some human beings. And I think, but I'm not going to argue the matter here, that it's possible to justify the thought that at least some principles must be taken to have universal scope by reflecting on some of the assumptions that we unavoidably make when we commit ourselves to acting in ways that will create widespread effects. Once we think of others as agents who can affect us by their action, and of ourselves as agents who can affect others by ours, however indirectly, however remotely, we have, I think, to see others too as agents, and must then align at least some judgments that we make about their case to those that we make about our own case. Yet, even if we accept that at least some normative principles are going to have universal scope, why should we think that the specific principles set out in any of the human rights documents, Universal Declaration, European Convention or others, are the right place to start? Might not these lists be incomplete or defective or need revision? Why is so much contemporary discussion of the justification of human rights so accepting, one might say so relaxed, about the actual lists of rights declared in 1948 or 1950? Are the reasons, other than inconclusive, positivist and political reasons, to accept these specific lists of rights? I've come to think that the fact that so many are prepared to accept the standard lists is not because they're confident that they are the right lists, let alone demonstrably the right lists, but rather because the rights listed are highly indeterminate, so that some interpretation of virtually all of them would be included in any plausible list of universal rights. In short, the magic that secures such widespread agreement to human rights is largely that the list in the Universal Declaration allows people to bracket so much that is contentious or about which they disagree. So I think it's, after all, not very surprising that many who think that human rights standards need deeper justification, the positivist and pluralist stories won't do, are nevertheless remarkably accepting of the Universal Declaration list. It doesn't follow that there's wide agreement about which of many possible interpretations of those rights is to be preferred. And there are persistent disputes about the adequacy or inadequacy of interpretations of, for example, freedom of expression and rights to privacy, rights to life and rights to security, which illustrate the point. So do earlier disputes, for example, about the right to work, a major dispute between market and centrally planned societies before 1990 was whether the right to work was about a free labour market or about the right to be assigned to a job. Quite different. The Universal Declaration list of rights poses, rather than resolves, certain questions of justification, difficult questions, and I think they can only be addressed by selecting or rejecting more specific interpretations of each indeterminate right. And the indeterminacy of the Universal Declaration rights reinforces the point that we can't derive justification from the mere fact that states have signed up or ratified the relevant international instruments, and some, but fewer of them, have tried to legislate to realise their commitments, and some, but even fewer, actually try to enforce the legislation that they enacted. The situation is rather, I suggest, that relatively indeterminate standards provide us starting points for reaching a justifiable interpretation of rights, but rather different starting points might also have proved adequate, for the hard issues arise further ahead and have to be addressed in moving from indeterminacy to one or another coherent and more specific interpretation of the range of rights. But here I suggest we can say something about justification. This very interesting cup is held below the waterline. I better drink some of it. The issues and concerns that have to be addressed in selecting or rejecting interpretations of rights aren't, I think, technical questions about implementation. Questions about implementation also matter, but I'm not going to say anything about them. They're more fundamental questions on which legislators, commentators, and in democracies, citizens need to form and to justify their views. While implementations could be ranked by relatively uncontentious criteria, for example, efficacy, efficiency, expense, there are no similarly technical standards for ranking interpretations. But the necessary constraints on any adequate interpretation of the Declaration or Convention rights, nevertheless, I'm going to argue, are quite powerful. They rule out many alternatives. They make it possible to go quite a long way towards justifying human rights. Even if we lack the metaphysical or theological foundations that would satisfy the standards Berlin sets for monistic justifications, a robust justification of demanding constraints on any adequate interpretation of rights is feasible. And this is because any coherent interpretation of the Universal Declaration of Rights, or any other listing one started with, has to satisfy at least three formal constraints. It must secure consistency between interpretations of the various rights held by each person. Consistency between the interpretations of the rights of each person and others like rights, and consistency between the interpretations of the rights of each person and the action needed to secure respect for those rights. I'm going to come back to those three in different ways. An immediate corollary of requiring that any interpretation of rights for all be consistent in these three ways is that very few rights could be seen as unconditional. At most, a few important liberty rights could be interpreted as absolute. The right not to be tortured, perhaps, the right not to be enslaved. These are often said to be absolute, meaning that no other consideration, including no other right, provides an acceptable reason for restricting them. But most human rights have to be constrained, the standard phrase is qualified, in lots of ways, if the rights of each person are to be compatible with one another, compatible with others enjoying the same rights, and compatible with the action needed to respect or realise those rights. The task of interpreting human rights, other than those few that might be absolute, is sometimes described as a matter of balancing one right against others. I think this metaphor is quite misleading. Its proper context is, I suggest, in judicial decision-making about particular cases, where balancing considerations is a matter of taking multiple facts into account. But in considering the justification of human rights, we're not dealing with particular cases, we're dealing with principles, and since there's no particular case, there are no facts of the case to be balanced. There is no metric for rights analogous to the metrics we use in physical balances. What's actually required in the first place is an interpretation of each right that adjusts it to others held by the same person, takes account of the fact that each right's to be enjoyed by all, and does not obstruct or prevent the action that respect for each right requires, i.e. it allows for the performance of the counterpart duties that are needed to make a reality of rights. Difficult questions clearly have to be decided. For example, what line should we draw between rights to freedom of expression and to privacy? In which ways can rights to life, liberty and security for all be made compatible with rights to fair trials for those accused of endangering others' life, liberty and security? How are rights to food to be met compatibly with respecting food producers' rights to freedom, to work and to property? In solving these problems, I sometimes think it's helpful to have more rather than fewer constraints. It narrows down the range of possibilities. We're all quite familiar with equations that can be solved only if one knows enough constraints, or for that matter with crossword puzzles, where solving each clue constrains possibilities for solving future clues, but is helpful for completing the puzzle. Justifications of specific interpretations of human rights can also, I suggest, make headway by focusing on the necessary constraints on any set of rights that can be rights for all. The power of consistency constraints is easily missed if one tries to think about rights or their interpretation one right at a time. That's a very popular approach, particularly from people who have a favourite right, say a right to freedom of expression, and they think that a maximal interpretation of that right's what's needed. In fact, it's a hopeless approach, for even given the first of the consistency requirements, that the several rights of a given individual be mutually consistent, can't be resolved by thinking about that individual's rights one at a time. For example, if we were to consider rights one at a time, it would be easy to imagine that the best interpretation of any given right is going to be a maximal interpretation. But this will be at the cost of overlooking what is needed for individuals to enjoy other rights. If A had a maximal right to liberty, she could not also have a right to security, since some measures required to protect her security would restrict her liberty. Obviously not all measures, but some of them. If A had a maximal... I won't give other examples. Unfortunately, some enthusiasts for particular rights have overlooked this elementary consistency requirement, and they waste time searching for maximal interpretations of their favourite rights, without attending to the ways in which maximal interpretations will distort, obstruct, or indeed obliterate the interpretation of other rights of the same individual, let alone those of other individuals. The second consistency requirement sets even more powerful constraints on any adequate interpretation of rights. Human rights, we take it, are rights for everyone, for all human beings, not just for some privileged ones. So no interpretation of rights is going to be acceptable if it implies that the right could be held only by some, not by all. There cannot, therefore, for example, be universal rights to positional goods, no universal right to win, to be the richest, the best, to enjoy upward social mobility. None of us lives in that magical world of Lake Wobegon where all the children are above average. If rights are universal, we have to reject as spurious any interpretation of a right under which it could not be held by all. nor can any adequate interpretation of rights endorse supposed rights whose successful exercise would prevent others from enjoying like rights. So there can therefore be no rights to coerce, to destroy, to control others. They would all evidently undermine others' like rights. Nor can anybody's freedom of movement be interpreted as an unrestricted right to occupy any chosen location on the surface of the earth, since this would be incompatible with others enjoying a like right. These reasons against considering rights one at a time filter out many unsatisfactory possibilities. A's right to privacy must be construed in ways that are compatible with B's right to a fair trial, C's right to liberty in ways that are consistent with D's right to security, E's right to food in ways that are consistent with F's rights to grow and sell food, and so on and so on, with a very large number of constraints. But the third powerful consistency constraint on any adequate interpretation of rights arises from the fact that rights will not and cannot be respected or realized unless there are others, individuals or institutions, as the case may be, who are required to discharge the counterpart duties needed to realize the right. No way of adjusting rights to one another can guide action unless it also leaves room for the action and forbearance required if they're to be respected or realized. So, any adequate interpretation of human rights for a given society at a given time has to take a clear view about whose action is required if those rights are to be respected. And in thinking about this, we have to ask not only which rights can consistently be held by all, but also which counterpart duties on others, who are themselves right holders, are compatible with everyone's rights. It's not enough merely to accept or assume that everyone has each listed right. Rights shorn of counterpart duties are no more than rhetoric and gesture, and the fundamental task of justifying rights is to find an interpretation under which each person can coherently have all of a range of rights, and they're not merely rhetorical because they can be matched to and secured by a pattern of duties that could respect and realise those rights. Following through the ways in which these constraints interact is, I suppose, rather like looking at a moderately complicated, not intellectually complicated, but a lot of cases, a simultaneous equation. Undoubtedly, these consistency constraints would have somewhat different implications for the interpretation of liberty rights and rights to goods and services. I prefer that phrase to welfare rights because I think it's more accurate. Consider first the simpler case of classical liberty rights. Each person's liberty rights will be incomplete unless everyone and every institution has a duty to respect them. Your right to freedom of expression will be vulnerable if anybody else has a right to censor, silence, or gag you. But it may have to be shaped in specific ways to make it compatible with your other rights and others' like rights. Your right to freedom of movement will be vulnerable if anybody has a right to prevent or restrain your movement, but it may have to be limited to secure like rights for others, for example, by limiting the freedom of movement of those convicted of serious crimes. A system of liberty rights makes demands on everyone. Moreover, liberty rights will not be secured if they're construed merely as demands not to interfere with each right holder. Liberty rights will be fragile unless they're institutionalized, and that institutional backing has to ensure that people actually respect rather than aim to ensure that people actually respect rather than violate them. So while the primary duties that correspond to liberty rights will be held by all individuals and all institutions, securing respect for them typically requires secondary action, second order obligations, by specified state and other institutions that back up performance of the counterpart duties and sanction breaches and failures. Things are even more complicated in the case of rights to goods or services, e.g. rights to food or to healthcare. Here the required counterpart duties have to be carried by specified persons and institutions rather than by everyone. It's literally impossible for everyone to feed each hungry person or look after each person's health when they're ill. Unless the primary duties to provide food or healthcare allocated, and indeed allocated to specific individuals and institutions with the competence and the capacity to discharge them, at least some people's rights to food or health care are going to be ignored or violated or both. Allocating duties to provide goods and services, let alone enforcing those duties when allocated, is of course a hugely demanding task. Typically, states that try to realise some adequate version of these rights build on existing cultural and institutional patterns of requirement, seeking to adjust them where they risk violating or failing to secure rights, and to buttress them where compliance is weak. International human rights architecture makes this explicit by assigning second-order duties to introduce an effective allocation of duties if an existing or customary assignment of duties is inadequate, and this task too is constrained by the three types of consistency requirement I've mentioned. The complexity of these interlocking consistency requirements means that any coherent interpretations of a plurality of rights is going to have to meet quite exacting criteria. The full set of rights must be given an interpretation under which any given individual can have versions of the range of rights, under which all individuals can have that range of rights, and under which the duties that must be met in order to respect and realise them can be met. Quite a tall order. It may not show that, and I think it could not show, that there's a single optimal interpretation of human rights, but it's likely to provide quite a robust way of identifying inadequate interpretations that ought to be rejected. The justification of human rights seen in this way is therefore a task to be achieved, rather than something supplied by some value monist or other algorithm or intuition. An interpretation of rights that meets all three consistency tests will, of course, not demonstrate that there's one and only one justifiable configuration of human rights, but it will offer robust justification that rules out many possibilities and limits variation. Well, I don't think that this approach reinstates any version of value monism. And it also doesn't establish anything about values that lie beyond the framework of rights. That is not because I assume that rights are the only important ethical or political values, but because this is a domain of reasoning about action in which consistency constraints can do some heavy lifting. In thinking about human rights, we must consider interlocking universal entitlement to others' action and requirements to act. I also think that there are arguments that can justify at least some values that do not have corresponding rights, the so-called classical imperfect duties, but I'm not going to say anything about them. But I hope I've shown that we don't have to settle either for political or positivist justifications of human rights and their counterpart duties. There are reasons for taking human rights seriously that can be offered to those who aren't inclined to do so. The temptation of these justification-light approaches to rights that pluralists and positivists have proposed these last 30 or 40 years are, of course, very great, and the ways in which they've been argued are often rather impressive, but I don't think they're adequate, precisely because they're predicated on appeals to the facts of agreement, the facts of ratification, the facts of enactment, where there are such facts. Pluralist and positivist substitutes for justification have nothing to say to others who do not agree, to others who are not fellow citizens, or to states that ignore human rights. So I think that while Berlin was right that value pluralism fails as justification, he was not right in fearing that we can therefore give no reasons for taking rights seriously that should weigh with others who do not agree with us. There are powerful strategies for justifying rights that can take us quite a long way. Thank you very much.